And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from Volunteers of America, Delaware Valley, we have Amanda Lease. She is Senior Vice President of Operations, and Allison Assatola. She is the Senior Vice President for Government Relations. And welcome, ladies. Thank you both for being on today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Anybody who listens to my show knows that Dan Lombardo was on just a couple of weeks ago talking about your efforts working with the poor, the elderly, with children, and your vast programming that you offer. And of course, one of the areas that you are involved with is human trafficking. And we're going to talk about that today. Definitely, it's a subject that we all should be and need to be more aware of. But first, you want to give us that nutshell elevator speech about what is Volunteers of America?
Sure. So Volunteers of America Delaware Valley, we are the local affiliate of a larger national nonprofit organization, Volunteers of America. And we have the privilege of serving the 11 southern counties in New Jersey, as well as Philadelphia and the state of Delaware, providing services in over 40 evidence-based driven programs. So we have contracts with the Department of Corrections, with parole. We also provide a significant amount of housing, whether it's emergency shelter placement, first month's rent security deposit, mental health services, substance abuse treatment services. But specific to today's conversation, we have state appropriations through New Jersey that allow us to serve victims and survivors of human trafficking, as well as federal dollars to do the work.
I've done shows on human trafficking in the past, and I know that it takes many forms, from nail salons, people who are working in nannies, housekeeping, yard and road work. But today we're going to be talking about sex trafficking. Tell us, what is sex trafficking?
Sure. So we refer to the basic definition that is offered by the Department of Homeland Security, and that human trafficking, it involves some type of coercion or force. At times we've seen fraud, and it's to obtain some form of commercial sex act. That's its very, very basic definition. Depending on where you look, you'll see other definitions that get into much more detail. As far as our organization goes, we're not questioning eligibility for services when it comes to human trafficking. We are taking the survivor and we are making sure that they get all of the different services that they need. But I think what's really, really unique about our organization is we have a three-pronged approach to combat human trafficking. So we partner with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to be delivering educational components into our school systems. We also do a significant amount of outreach. So we work side by side with the state police and the Cherry Hill Police Department to do those operations. So when survivors are recovered, we're able to provide immediate services. And then we do the continued care management and follow-up pieces, providing trauma-informed care, linking them with the necessary services, but also acting as the liaison when their trafficker is going to trial.
Who is being trafficked? And I know that that's a broad paintbrush there, but do you want to talk a little bit about who is vulnerable to this?
So I think when you talk about human trafficking, the first thing that comes to most people's minds are children, our youth, juveniles. So one thing that we, you know, read a lot on and in speaking with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, you really need to recognize that our missing youth can often be targeted by traffickers. And so they're youth that are running away from something at home that are reported missing. And if those that are recovering them are not handling the situation appropriately, we may be missing the opportunity to identify signs of human trafficking. Other vulnerable populations include adults with intellectual disabilities. We've seen a lot of females targeted that think they're entering into a dating relationship and end up being trafficked. So I don't think that we can get too specific on the type of vulnerable populations, as unfortunately, the farther into the work we get, you know, we're seeing all types of backgrounds in the survivors we're working with.
According to your website and the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, it says that a half of the sex trafficking victims are between the ages of 4 and 17.
Mm-hmm. It's an alarming number. It raises eyebrows every time we discuss it. But I think that's why it's so important that we're educating our youth and our parents and our guardians, because there's a lot of preventative work that we can be doing. And there's a lot of conversations that are really, really difficult to have both at home and in schools, but the conversations that we need to be having. I really applaud New Jersey. We have guidelines in place where human trafficking needs to be talked about in our school systems. And we're just really, really happy to have the partnership with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to help deliver that content into our schools.
When we talk about, you alluded to children who are likely to run away, being vulnerable, missing children. Are some kids visible? I mean, still in high school, still showing up at school. These aren't kids that just disappear off the face of the earth. No one knows where they are. A lot of these kids are in, I don't want to say hiding, but they are right there in plain sight, aren't they?
Yes. So we really try not to use the term runaway. It has very negative connotations. We, you know, really, when we have different conferences or different educational sessions, we try to steer clear of that. And reason being, when we ask people what's associated with that word compared to the word missing, you know, obvious differences. And so a lot of times when you say a child is missing, there's different resources that may be allocated or things that go through people's minds that are more resourceful than if you say runaway. A lot of times there's a very negative connotation. And so when we talk about those children, to your point, yes, they are in plain sight. From different trainings that we've gone to, there are recruiters in schools. Some recruiters may be high school students themselves trying to get other students trafficked or into, I guess, the relationships, for lack of a better word, that they're involved in.
Let's back it up then. How does one recognize trafficking? What are the signs that someone is being coerced or someone is being trafficked? Obviously, a child, no consent possible. So
with children, there's a lot of red flags or indicators. And when you go through them, you may think, oh, well, that's, you know, a typical child. You really need to pay attention to gaming systems. Are they closing their door when they're on a gaming system? Are they using the chat feature? Are they getting embarrassed, upset, or nervous when you enter the room and your child is on one of those chat settings? The other red flag that we've noticed is, and again, a lot of this is through different trainings that we've had, but is your child coming home with expensive gifts where you haven't provided the money to have those gifts? Is your child coming home with bruises that you're not quite sure where those bruises have come from? One thing we talk about with hospital staff, do you have someone in the room that another person is with them? They don't answer a question without looking to the adult or the colleague, peer, whoever's in the room with them to answer for them. There's a lot of different red flags depending on the type of victim and the situation that they're in. The other thing that we've noticed is, especially with teenagers, healthy versus unhealthy relationships. And so there's a lot of pieces that coincide with what we consider everyday life. And social media, to an extent, complicates all of that when it comes to human trafficking.
What role does social media play in all of this? You mentioned the gaming systems, which is a kind of a form of community discussion or a forum. How has that affected or impacted the numbers or how children are taken?
So social media gives traffickers access to victims, yes, through gaming systems, but also through social media applications. Snapchat, right? We have youth that think everything disappears. Well, nothing quite disappears off the internet. I have to say, NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, actually has a program called Take It Down, where you can contact them and they can remove explicit images from the internet. So while the internet has provided access, in my opinion, more access for traffickers, I give a lot of credit to the different organizations out there that are providing resources to take that type of content down.
It's sort of like when you mentioned the woman who thinks she's entering a dating relationship, a kid taking a photo and sending it, and then that's blackmail.
Correct. And we started having the conversation, but we haven't dived too far into it yet about AI. So we were informed of, you know, children who are posting images on the internet that they may be with their family, they may be with their friends. There is nothing explicit about the photo whatsoever. However, someone can then take their face, put it on a different image, and then use that to blackmail a child. So, you know, what the internet offers, it can be very, very scary and can be used in a very negative way. And what we're seeing with AI moving forward is very concerning.
I'm going to go a little bit off topic here, but when I was talking to Dan, he was talking about his concerns for, and I think, Allison, you're going to be jumping in here on this part, but his concerns that in 2026, we're going to have so many big events in the Delaware Valley. And he alluded to that we are in a sex trafficking corridor. Can you explain a little bit about this and how it's going to impact, well, the crime, and how it's going to impact, well, your services at this trying time?
I will defer to Amanda once again on this, but I think I'll at the same time give her major kudos, because Amanda was working in Atlantic City and noticed, you know, doing other social services, and noticed there's a huge, you know, human trafficking issue. You know, you have the casinos there, you have all of these sort of, you know, pay by the hour motels. And Amanda and her staff, you know, really started identifying, hey, this is a really huge issue in Atlantic City, and really grew this program from the ground up. And I think one of the very unique things about it is the partnership with law enforcement, which, as Amanda said, sometimes, you know, in the world of reentry, especially, you know, social services and law enforcement partnerships are frowned upon, but it's been hugely successful. And I think, and again, I'll defer to Amanda's expertise on this, but Bergen County is also a huge human trafficking hotspot. And I believe, and this is, you know, something that I think I've heard from, you know, our various trainings that Amanda alluded to, is just the location of like major highways, like 95, right? Proximity to other states, proximity to large airports, large transit stations. But certainly, you know, I think New Jersey is gearing up, and we're already seeing some legislation, as we've alluded to, around kind of especially the World Cup. And I'll let Amanda speak to this, but I think one of the things that Amanda and her team have identified is services leading up to the event, services during the event, and then services after the event, because a lot of times with these large events, you know, the circus leaves town, right? You pull up stakes, everybody's gone, and then the survivors are kind of left wondering, where can I go, you know, for help?
You are right on. So, you know, when Dan talks about the corridor, it's what Allison just mentioned, right? So you have 95, you have all the transportation hubs. It's very, very easy to go back and forth from New York, Philadelphia, Maryland. So it's just something to keep in mind. And, you know, we had all these conversations, but then as we were running programming and we were working with survivors, you listen to their story and they tell you how they were held in a different part of the state, but trafficked in another area. And so, yes, the transportation hubs in the corridor through East and West and North and South Jersey, it does, unfortunately, and this might not sound right, but it makes it easy to transport victims. The casinos, they've seen their fair share of it. We are very, very lucky, though, in Atlantic City to have strong state police partnerships, strong partnerships with Atlantic City Police Department and the casinos, and that they want to have a role in combating human trafficking. And so the state police and the attorney general's office are offering trainings at the casinos, and we're really working together, you know, to combat this problem. And Allison mentioned it, and I'm probably going to say it 50 more times before this is over, but the partnership between law enforcement and providers is the key here. And we didn't really see that happen for a lot of years. And it's something our organization is very, very proud of, because I like to consider us at the forefront of forming those relationships and spreading them statewide.
I'm going to guess that the coercion and shame and the captivity would prevent someone from coming forward themselves. So a lot of people are going to be entering your services through law enforcement. Is that the way most end up coming to take advantage of what you have to offer for reentry?
Most come through law enforcement. We do have some that come through hospital systems. So they will be in an emergency room, or they'll be in a longer term hospital stay, depending on how medically fragile they are. And there may be a nurse, social worker in the hospital, or a nurse that they confide in, and they know to pick up the phone and call us. It's also a call to law enforcement. Sometimes, you know, our staff need to be kept safe as well. So in transporting the survivor, we're going to need assistance from law enforcement. Not all survivors can be kept in New Jersey. We do have to relocate some. And so having those law enforcement partnerships is also helpful. But to law enforcement's credit, a lot of the victims and survivors that we're working with, we are being introduced to at the operation where they're recovered. So we are side by side in a room right next to the state police or in the room with the Cherry Hill Police Department, that when they have a female who they suspect may be a human trafficking victim, they're not talking about, you know, perhaps what criminal activity may have been about to happen. They're actually handing them over to us for the social services and the trauma-informed care piece. And I think that's what's most important, and that's what's so special about the departments that we partner with.
I know that you do conferences. How are your peers being educated? And that includes those emergency room nurses or the sergeant on the desk who sent somebody out to know to send a social worker along the way. How are you all in concert with this approach?
So I like to say that we don't do the training. We're just really good at pulling all the experts and all the stakeholders together. So we rely heavily on the Attorney General's office in New Jersey, as well as the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So we have relationships with all of the different stakeholders. They provide the training or the training materials. And then we make sure that everything we're hosting or doing is side by side with law enforcement. What's really, really nice is the National Center and the AG's office, they actually will do trainings that we can all be in one room, all getting the same content. So we're all on the same page. I think what sometimes gets lost is law enforcement and providers, we have to operate in different systems. We have different regulations, different policies, different rules that we all have to play by. But when we're training together, we can understand what the other one's there to do in the systems we're working in. And we put everything aside and understand that the survivor is the sole priority in that moment, and we'll figure out the rest a couple of minutes later. And I think that's what's really, really nice about training together.
You talked about you have trauma-informed workers. You're going to be caring for this survivor. But what about the children who are picked up? And I hate to ask this, but often they can't go back to their family. Their family might be involved.
Familial trafficking, yes, it is a very real thing. It's a very big problem. A lot of times there may be other family members that they can go to who maybe didn't know what was going on in the home. Unfortunately, some may need to be turned over to state care. At the same time, there are systems in place to make sure that they continue to get the trauma-informed care that they need. It looks different. We work with more adults than children. The services that we provide long-term are for adults only. So I know Covenant House does a lot of work with juveniles who have been trafficked. And to their credit, it's really tough work and really important work to do. And so they run a lot of that programming in New Jersey.
Well, the woman, though, who maybe turned 18 or turned 21 and has been trafficked for 4 or 5 years. Let's just take her, for example. She's been recovered. She's been found. Mm-hmm. And you're on the scene. What happens to her?
Sure. So when we go into the community on an operation, we're in very non-intimidating clothing, right? So no one wants to have a conversation with someone in a suit. So a lot of times our team is dressed down, our law enforcement partners are dressed down, and there's normally separate space for us to be able to talk to them. Some survivors aren't going to want to talk to us in a closed space. We may need to go outside and get some fresh air. There are times they may just want to go for a walk. It all depends on what their need is in that moment. We try to, you know, basic conversations. Are you hungry? You know, do you need to call anyone as far as your family goes? What do you need? Because in that moment, it's not what we think they should do. That's not important. It's what that survivor needs to feel safe. And then once we start that conversation, there are times they can, you know, just sit in a room with us for a half an hour and not say anything, and a half an hour later be ready to talk. When they are ready, we provide the immediate placement, whether it's in a shelter or housing, depending on where law enforcement feels they're safe to be placed. And then whatever needs they may have, if they need to be, you know, to go to the hospital for medical care, whatever that looks like. A lot of times, they're pretty quiet for the first 24 hours, so we'll go and meet with them the next day. Typically, what we see, though, is a lot of paranoia, and rightfully so, right? They're not sure, you know, if a family member was threatened prior to them coming and meeting with us. They're not sure if their family's safe. They're not sure who they can trust and who they can't. So a lot of times it's just trust building for the first couple of days, and then little by little working with law enforcement to get the information on the trafficker.
Some of these will have children, too.
Mm-hmm. yes, we have worked with survivors who have children. Some have had children prior to being trafficked. Some have had children while being trafficked. And so it's getting services for the family. The services sound very basic as we're talking about them now, but obviously there's a lot of moving pieces. One of the hardest things for people to understand is when one of the females we were working with needed medical treatment, but getting undressed to be examined after getting recovered from that situation is not always easy. So it's also reaching out to our community partners, letting them know we have a potential human trafficking victim and making sure that those sensitive pieces are in place. You know, a common routine exam in a medical office is not so common or routine when you've been trafficked for the last couple months.
When someone is recovered, I'm going to suppose that they don't have a suitcase with them. They don't have maybe a bag, a purse, or a wallet, or maybe their trafficker is holding their paperwork. Mm-hmm. They might not be documented properly.
So a lot of the survivors that we've worked with are documented. However, their trafficker is holding their identification. And so there's no form of ID, no social security card, no birth certificate. If we do work with a survivor who does have a bag on them, that's a safety blanket for them. And so we try to be very mindful and respectful of that. And, you know, it's very difficult because when you're working with law enforcement, they want all the information they can get. But at the same time, that little bit of information the survivor has is all they have. And so it's finding that balance, getting them new identification. They're all steps that can take a while. And again, I think what we don't think of that really comes into play here is if you're being held in one part of the state and trafficked in another, and you're using public transportation, telling a human trafficking survivor to take public transportation to go to the DMV is not as easy as it is for someone who hasn't been.
How long do you provide services for a victim? And what are some of the services that you offer?
We don't discharge at all. So we are here as long as they need us. We have some survivors that, you know, I can't believe where they're at. Very, very proud, you know, of the jobs that they're holding and the way they're impacting and giving back to their communities after what they've been through. And, you know, maybe a couple years down the road, they have they have another relapse with substance abuse or something triggers them or they see something that just, you know, sends them off their course. We're there to help them work through those pieces. As far as what services look like, it's whatever the need is. So maybe it's detox, maybe it's mental health treatment. When they get out of treatment, it's stable housing, it's job training, it's education. We're working with them every step of the way. I think the important thing to remember is a lot of those services sound like basic social services, but when you're working with a human trafficking survivor, each step can take a lot longer.
How do we get involved? Is it by becoming educated? What does the public need to know and what do we need to do?
I think education and conversations, having real conversations. You know, we hear, oh, you know, only women are trafficked or only children are trafficked. Or, you know, to Allison's point, human trafficking will get a lot of attention because the World Cup's coming. But when the World Cup is over, those survivors still need a significant amount of care. And so educating our youth, having the conversations and not being afraid to say something when it seems off, they're all key components for what we as a community can do.
How do we get educated? How do we start these conversations? Where do we get the tips for, you know, sitting down?
Sure.
It ain't the dinner table conversation usual.
It isn't. It's one I've had at my dinner table, unfortunately. But the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they have a link on their website called NetSmarts, and you can actually create an account. And it really walks you through Human Trafficking 101. And it also has content on how to have the conversations at home, difficult conversations. It has information for providers. It has information for schools. It's a really, really great resource that has a significant amount of online materials that can be utilized.
Oh, speaking of resources, you do have an annual summit.
Yes. So we are in the planning phase of our 2025 Human Trafficking Summit. It will be in March at Rowan University. Allison and I are working on the content. We are really thinking about targeting our state's efforts in anticipation of the World Cup. All of our summits are law enforcement and social services together, as we've been talking about for the last half an hour. And so more information and save the date will be on our website, we're hoping by mid-January.
And obviously you do have state support in New Jersey.
You know, we've had great support from Senator Troy Singleton. He's done a lot of great legislation around human trafficking. He was the keynote at, I believe, VOADB's first human trafficking summit. Is that right, Amanda?
Yes. And then Senator, yeah.
Yep, Senator, so Majority Leader Teresa Ruiz has been our keynote for 2 years now, and she's done a lot of great work. Assemblywoman Carol Murphy, there's a whole host of, we have really great legislators, you know, and you know, previous to her retirement, Senator Majority Leader Loretta Weinberg did a lot of legislation, as Amanda referenced, about requiring, you know, signage to be up in transportation hubs, you know, telling folks a number they can call and, you know, other ways to access resources if you see something or if you yourself are being victimized. So we're very grateful also for our legislative partnerships and partnerships with the governor's office. So we also have, and this is, again, all due to Amanda and her team being really good at what they do and getting on people's radars. But, you know, we got some generous funding from Congressman Norcross. And then also had the pleasure of meeting with Congressman Smith, his staff in Washington, D.C., and Amanda and one of her law enforcement partners spoke at a summit that the congressman spoke at in Monmouth County.
If I'm hearing this, and maybe I don't have kids, I'm just Joe me. What do I need to know? What should I be aware of, or what can I do in to support your work?
Once you go online and educate yourself through resources like NCMEC, the one thing I always say is trust your gut. If you see something and it doesn't seem right, there's probably something there. And at the end of the day, if it ends up not being human trafficking, maybe it's domestic violence. Maybe it's something else, but you've helped another person. And I think that's really all that matters.
How do you approach the person?
So in my opinion, no, I would never approach someone because you don't, you know, you're putting yourself at risk in that moment. But it doesn't hurt to talk to a store owner if that's where you are. It doesn't hurt to grab law enforcement or security and just put on their radar that something doesn't seem right. In New Jersey, we do a great job of training our business owners and putting up signage. And so a lot of times, you can always call the tip line, but a lot of times just talking to a business owner or security nearby will put it on their radar a lot faster. And I think we don't talk about, as a state, the great trainings that our state does offer for different groups in our community.
And where do we access them? How do we find out about all of these?
Sure. So you can go to the state's website, the Attorney General's website. They have a whole section on our Human Trafficking Commission in New Jersey. They have resources that you can download. If you're a business owner, you can hang them up in your store. And then, as always, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And there's different links to the different state resources.
We've been talking about New Jersey. I hear this. I'm in Pennsylvania. Maybe I'm in Delaware. Do you support victims in these states?
Yes. 100%. As an organization, we're not turning anyone away.
When somebody would like to call you for help, maybe it's someone who hears this and they are ready, could they contact you directly?
So survivors that have come directly through our programs go to the closest VOA program, whether it's mental health, whether it's reentry, whether it's outreach programming, and they get in touch with us that way. So it's whatever location is closest to them. It doesn't happen too often. The majority is through our law enforcement partners or during an operation with them or from a hospital system. But yes, they can go to their local VOADV program, and everyone has access to the human trafficking specialist that works statewide at VOADV.
Parting words, Allison first.
I just, you know, thank all the work that Amanda and her team have done in creating this great program, which, as you said, is service oriented, but also educational oriented. And thank, you know, our great partners, you know, law enforcement, community partners, the New Jersey Legislature, the Attorney General's Office, and the Governor's Office, doing a lot of great work. And I'm sure we'll meet the challenge of making sure that everyone's safe and has access to services for the upcoming World Cup.
Amanda.
I think Allison said it all. Just thank you for having us discuss this incredibly important topic and, you know, just getting the information and the education out there and making sure that our community communities are aware.
Always for information about Volunteers of America, they are very easy to find. VOADV, that's for Volunteers of America, Delaware Valley, VOADV.org. And of course, for more information about educational resources, for more information about all the programming that they offer, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Just Google search them and you will find a wealth of information there as well. That's the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And ladies, thank you so much for doing this today. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest, Allison Assatolo. She is the Senior Vice President for Government Relations, and Amanda Lease, Senior Vice President of Operations for the Volunteers of America, Delaware Valley. And again, find them at voadv.org. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.